What I want, what I wanted to start with this one is by Robert Hamlin. It's called Big Apple. And if anyone ever read the book, The Courting of Marcus Dupree by Willie Morris, the story of just how Marcus Dupree went from being a star running back to a has-been, it'll break your heart. This poem might do the same thing. It's called Big Apple. From our vantage point as seventh graders, looking up and dreaming, you had it all. Prettiest girl in the entire school, hero status, a starting tailback, a swaggering, confident manner that made everyone, even the adults who should have known better, believe in your invincibility. And that most fascinating of all nicknames, which even years later when I heard it applied to New York, still retained that boyhood association with you. Friday nights, huddled under blankets and rickety wooden bleachers on the home side of the field, we waited, adoring, faithful devotees, for that supreme moment when you would take the handoff, almost disappear in a crowd of linemen, then, springing free of their clutches, miraculously and joyfully explode into the secondary, racing past linebackers and defensive backs, coasting on the wave of our fanatical cheering, the last few strides into the end zone. But then your life stopped like a block punt, a frame frozen as those grainy films coaches endlessly review to try and figure out why the game plan broke down. You didn't marry the girl. You didn't get the college scholarship. You didn't, so far as we knew, even find a regular job. By the time I became a senior and number two center, you were just another washed-up jock as forgotten as last year's sports page. Sometimes we'd see you in the crowd, never cheering, just watching, brooding, more often than not disapprovingly, even contemptuously, as the underclassmen, one of them wearing your old number, now claim the field, the fans, the game. I never knew about the drinking until I read about your death in the paper. An event stranger, more mysterious than your nickname are those Friday night moves. Nobody learned what started the fire or where the night watchman had been, only that you, drunk again, had been arrested and thrown into the town jail, its only prisoner that fateful night, and that you died of suffocation before the firemen could extinguish the blaze. When they found your body, it was still lying on the cot, limp as the dressing room in defeat, emptied of all that former speed and energy and grace, and locked in a gasp heavier and more certain than any linebacker's or safety's life and death, being the only opponents you couldn't duck, stiff arm, or juke.
Wow.
Yeah. Robert Hamlin is a really good poet, and over the years I've admired so much of the next one we're going to do is by Dale Ritterbusch, who's been with us before, but I don't believe he read this poem when he was with us. Dale is a great poet, and I'm not really stalling here. It's just that I have to scroll through because it's not in the book, and I couldn't bookmark them, but we will be there soon. And this is a poem called Running at Night, and it reminds me very much of the sense you have when you're young. And sometimes, you know, you have to go out for your run in the evening or whatever, and it's just a different time to be out. So this is called Running at Midnight. With each stride, cinders crunch underfoot, and the only sound is of some nightbird calling. With earth and air cooled late, I can run farther, faster, longer on this old school track, the last cinder track in the city. My mind focuses on the inner ring of the oval circumscribing the football field. I stay tight to the inside, remember everything my high school coach taught me about running. I keep my hands loose, my arms pump with a steady rhythm. Finishing a hard mile, my legs heavy, my mouth filled with cotton, I sprint around the last turn, pour it on down the straight, and walk it off. A voice calls out, breaking the spell. Good night for a run. I search through the dark for that voice, find a young woman standing on her front lawn across the street. I try to catch my breath to tell her how much easier it is to run at night, in August, and how I do this almost every night in summer, when the heat of the day, whatever I have to do, drains the energy like an overloaded circuit. She walks across the narrow street while I put on my sweats under the goalposts. I listen as she talks about the quiet of late summer nights when she comes out to watch and listen to the stars. There's a note of longing in her voice, anticipation in the still air that tells me what she looks for. I draw back further into the shadows, back from the street lamp that might show her I'm too old to run like this, too old to tell her what she wants to hear. But it's only small talk, after all, something I've never been good at. I refrain from telling her the few things I know that I've learned circling the track, one run after another, night after night, season after season. She stands there between the goalposts and the cinders, her hands in her pocket, searching for words. I wish her well and jog back to whatever awaits, slowly, perceptibly, leaving her beneath the circling summer stars, all of us learning to pace ourselves as best we can, searching, calling, running through our nights. Some of the answers swirl like insects around a street lamp. Some of them flare to ash in the light.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Dale is really good. The next one is by someone that we was just here recently, and one of our favorite poets, Ron Smith. And it is interesting because it addresses something that's going to be coming up with us before too long. Okay, just got a few more pages to go. And that is, there's a book called God in the Stadium by a guy named Jack Higgs. And Jack Higgs will figure in this poem. I never got to meet Jack Higgs, but he was one of the early stalwarts of SLA and was apparently a person who everybody that knew him admired. And God in the Stadium was a look in 1995 at what would happen if corporations became more involved in big-time college football, or it became more identified with evangelical religion than it already was.
Imagine that, huh?
Imagine that. Do you think Jack was onto something?
Hmm.
All right, this is called Away. It has an epigraph from A.E. Houseman, who famously wrote to an athlete dying young, though this is not from that. Echoes list to silence, now where gods told lies of old. We were talking the usual bull, beer in hand, the light, the air light, the light like air, the river full of light, full of fish, Don said. And I had something about teaching, and Jack chuckled, yeah, that's what Emerson said. The first job of the teacher is to inspire. That was all shucks, Jack, with his mountain accent deeper than that river, warmer than the East Tennessee breeze. He hadn't played half rubber with us that day, the past time I hauled up from Savannah to inflict in an old apple orchard on those middle-aged boys from Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and, by God, Maine. But I reminded Jack of the softball game from a decade before when he had rounded third like a runaway freight, belly ballooning from the turn and scared the catcher away from the plate he hit with a slide that took our breaths away. Broom handle wood, solid rubber ball, baseball size cut down the middle, seems just about impossible to find in 21st century Johnson City. And I think now Jack did play, had the surest hands of the lot, a born half-rubber catcher right there where the river moves almost silently past the orchard and all around the mountains lean in. Lean in as the light seeps away, and Jack claps his palms together, grins, holds up thumb and forefinger, half a ball, and the boy from Maine still untwisting himself to see if he's really out. It was originally in the Appalachian Studies program thing. It's a great poem, and what really makes it resonate for me is that they were at Don Johnson's house, and the Watauga River runs right by his house. Fabulous fishing in the East Tennessee Mountains. Are right there. I mean, it's one of the most beautiful spots anybody I know lives.
Ron is so good.
Oh God, and he just gets better. And every time I see him, he's I have a new poem for you, Bruce. And he reads it, and I just think, why do I bother? You know, which is interesting because the next poem is one of mine, I'm reading this because every sugar loafer out there who's listening will know exactly what I'm talking about. The wind at Sugarloaf at the summit, because it's so exposed, can be incredibly much higher than it is elsewhere. And one of the things that it will do is if you have tried to set up a race the night before, you can't count on what you did being there when you go back. And once upon a time, not long ago, well, actually many years ago, my friend Mike Entwistle and I, he was down in Northeast Harbor at the time, volunteered to be the two guys who spent the night on the summit in the lift shack at the what was the top of the old spillway chair, where there were bunks and a bathroom and the like. So the first light, and this is December, so first light comes late, we could assess the wind damage and know whether we could run a race. This was a big race. It was very, very important. And so we got up there. They bribed us with a six-pack of good beer and a couple of pizzas and settled in for the night. And the anemometer never dropped below 60.
Wow.
A wind never that I saw. Midnight, a groomer knocked on the door and came in. And he was his job to check the anemometer. He goes, oh, 72 miles an hour. Not so bad. You know, they were hurricane winds. Well, this is about what we found the next morning. It begins with Mike and I. We got a ride on a groomer up to the top of the mountain called Sugarloaf December for Mike Twistle Entwistle. Alpenglow spilled on dimming day. Ineluctable wind across evening. Solstice moon turning towards winter. Pack buckle singing, skis shouldered, we trudged up the last 100 meters, you humming Marley and Toots. Hard packed, ear rasping snow, creaking brittle under our boots, wind slung like darts into watery eyes. Cold flows easily, artery and vein, heart and spleen, kidney and lungs, hallowed air and drifted ground. In the lift shack at the top of Spillway, our home for the short, bitter night, the anemometer never dips below 60. Skies clear, temperatures plummet, portending flesh-devouring gales in the weak rose light of the dawn. In the howl of midnight, a groomer bursts in to record the wind speed, astonished that we can sleep. With first light splashing the summit, 22 below bone zero, we smile at our rare good fortune. Our tracks will leave no trace in the wind-burnished snow, polished as white and bone-hard as an antler. Clicked in, we slide down narrow gauge along the length of the wind-savaged fences. In radio, there will be no race today.
That's excellent, Bruce.
That was a fun one. And do we have time for one more?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, great. Well, I would like to read this one, which is on page 103, which is not too far away, by Jack Riddle. Yes. It's called Assistant Coach. Those of us who are assistant coaches can really admire this, I think. Very short. He turns his back, holds up his wife's pearl mirror, glances into the glass at the bald spot, the size of a 50-cent piece centered in the back of his head. Then, cleaning the anarchy of hair from his comb, he thinks of when he could run his fingers through thick black curls, pull on a T-shirt, head for the gym, glad to assist, sure of building a winner all his own.
That's great.
Yeah, there's a,
love it.
I got another great John B. Lee one.
If we got time. Yeah, we got a minute or so. We got 2 minutes.
Then we'll save that for next time because it would run longer than that.
Yeah? How long? I can juggle some things.
Well, I've got to get to it, which is going to take me another 20, 30 seconds. I'm sure it's a couple of minutes anyway.
I'm not going anywhere. You know, we've got news coming up in a little bit, but we've got time if you want to drop it in before we go. By the way, next week, among others, we'll also talk with Steve Wiegand about his new book, The Uncommon Life of Danny O'Connell, A Tale of Baseball Cards, Average Players, and the True Value of America's Game next week.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. That sounds really good. Yeah, I wish I had the hard copy of this. If I did, I could do this much faster, but...
Now, is Tim Manners on with us next week?
No, he's going to be. He was going to be, but it turns out we have to do that next month.
Okay. All right.
All right. Here we are. John B. Lee's poem. Night gone, the shadow of God. When Mark turned gray at 11 o'clock on the dressing room bench, his skin lamping out like an autumn chameleon next to a stone in the rain, we knew his distress. And I saw of a sudden that these were good men. Lie down, one said with knowing concern. Take off your shoes. Are you sick? And they gathered around, one rubbing his legs like a lover, laughing a little, one feeling the blue dab of his pulse for slow sewing, watching his face for poor maps of the heart. And the room went round. Meant jests. A few of us stood in the ill and feckless circles of seen light, regarding his fear. Is he dying? I've seen men die like that. Last year we lost a few. the Iceman says, and he breathes from the sad, deep wells of himself to recall only half an hour before we'd been skating, trying our luck with a thrill to score, and have scored. We played well, yet here we were now, with the night gone, the shadow of God and Mark on the bench lying down, his eyelids like weeds in the wind. I can't feel myself, he says, seeing something other than us.
Wow.
John B. Lee is just fabulous.
That's excellent. Well, great stuff. All from the brand new edition of Athlon.
Yeah, it's a double edition. It's from the first one.
Excellent. Thanks, Bruce.
My pleasure.
Bruce Pratt, every Wednesday, Sports Lit 101.